Hello and welcome back to Coffee with Candace. I know it's been a long time since we launched the show again, but we are back and we are bigger than ever. I'm going to prove this to you by bringing back one of your all-time favorite guests, Alison Armstrong, who has spent 30 years understanding men. And she's the author of the best-selling book, The Queen's Code. Before I jump into Alison's interview, be sure to like, share, and subscribe so that more people will find us. And now, without further ado, here's Alison. Alison Armstrong, it is such an honor to have you back on Coffee with Candace. You are one of the guests that I have had the most feedback on. And I think a lot of the reason is, I think when we started speaking the last time, especially about understanding men, so many people came on and they thought we were going to bash men. We were not going to be a favor of them. And you completely came on and blew everyone away. So thank you for coming back.
You're welcome. You're welcome. I was not a fan of them in the beginning, as you know. So it's a cool process. Transformation. I love it.
Oh, talking about process, Alison. So I've been deeply immersed in your book, The Queen's Code, which is absolutely just life-changing. And I don't use those words, you know, lightly. I think genuinely for a lot of women out there, and I'd even say men, really reading the book and starting to understand how we operate, because sometimes we don't have that clear mirror in front of us, and also having real strategies as to how we can move forward, that we're not doomed. We're not doomed to failure, which I love about the book. But what I'm curious about, because you released the original copy of the physical book in 2010, and now you've released the audiobook. I want to know, what was the process behind that?
Oh, golly. Okay, I have to go back even before 2010. Okay. Because I started studying men in 1991. I knew in 1992 that I needed to write a book, because I'd, even in that short period of time, I'd learned so much about men that was contrary, if not completely in opposition to what I believed about them, because I was very normal, right? As a very normal woman. And what happens in The Queen's Code with Kimberly, in the first chapter, that happened to me. That happened to me. I was sitting in that seminar and my colleague and friend was called a frog farmer when she asked that question in only, I mean, so snarky. So it was an attack on all men. Why are men so wonderful in the beginning, right? And then change. And, you know, beer belching, pizza eating, couch slugs. She actually said that. And I had that vision of a farmhouse with a wraparound porch and rows of frogs with human heads. And I just was struck by, I'm a frog farmer. Oh my gosh, I'm a really successful frog farmer. And I actually prided myself on provoking men in such a way that what I thought was the con, right? Like the chivalrous gentleman, caring, concerned, romantic, amorous. I thought that was a con. And I wanted to get to the bottom of the con before I got sucked into it. And it seemed like a really good strategy. Until, his name is Herb Tanzer, said that to my friend Lisa, you're a frog farmer, right? Some women turn frogs into princes, you turn princes into frogs. And I have something to do with this, right? I thought I was just revealing who they really are. I didn't think I was like doing the equivalent of kicking the dog repeatedly and thinking it was a bad dog when it bit me or when it ran away. I didn't know any of that at the time. And So as I found that out, which was 6 months into studying men, it was pointed out to me by a woman I owe my life to. Her name is Ellen Hurst. All the ways that she'd seen me emasculate men or knew that I had, because she'd seen the result, including a really good friend of hers that I just ended an engagement with very badly. And so here I was, I kept learning, and I had the experience like Karen and Kimberly do in the book, where I didn't even have to do anything nice. I just had to stop doing what disempowers men, what antagonizes their instincts, like literally kicks the dog, literally brings out the worst in them. I was an expert at bringing out the worst in them, and I thought that was all of who they were. I didn't know that I was triggering, the way I would say it now in my work, I was attacking and they were having fight, flight, and freeze responses. And especially the fight response to being attacked is particularly an egregious crime, do you know, on men's part. We're supposed to be able to attack them and they're supposed to remain perfectly composed and generous and amazing, you know, partners. They're supposed to stay in partnership while we're going after their identity, going after their prime motivators, going after what gives them their own sense of safety. I thought I could go after that and a real man would take it. The real man wouldn't react in a real way to something that was really upsetting and demeaning, you know? So I knew I had to write this book in 1992. I kept talking to women about what I was learning about men. I kept talking to them about what if we laid down the sword? What if we stopped attacking them? And I kept encountering with each woman, there was a new justification. There was a new reason why they needed it, right? Why we needed to do it to them, right? That one of them was they abuse power. They have power and they abuse it, right? Another, my mom, they're stupid. I bet you encounter a lot of these, right? A lot of different ones. Yeah. Do you want to say anything about that?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, regardless of where you are in the world, a lot of the time, I think women bond through sometimes bashing men. And we say the absolute worst things about them that we would shudder if they said that about us. God forbid they would ever reference us as idiots or as, you know, they can't think. The only brain is between their legs. Like, it's just like the things we say about men, honestly, would just would kill us if we were on the receiving end of it.
Yeah. Yeah. And they would definitely be strung up for it. And women, we encourage each other, right? We encourage each other and we're even suspicious of someone who doesn't. Right. And so, by the way, I just got to hear your wind. It sounds like a teapot, not a coyote. It sounds like the tea's ready.
The water's, I'll take the tea.
The hot water's boiling. We can make tea now. That's what it sounded like.
Amazing. I love it.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, there it was again. It's going to be fine. You know, however you decide to edit or not edit, I'm sure it's just fine, especially because you set it up with me and you're not getting attacked by coyotes or a teapot. Okay. So if you can imagine, Candace, I had transformed the way I saw men. I still didn't know even a fraction of what I know now. I called it the transformation of the castration club. And one by one, you know, my mom, my stepsister, my new best friend, like one by one, I was interacting with what had them justify it. And invite them to see things from a different point of view. Like my friend Joan, who ended up starting our company, PAX, with me, she was a vice president of a bank. And she took on, it was so, we called it the TIE Project, where instead of being critical of the men who worked for her, she took on being, paying attention in a good way, right? Both men and women need attention and will do things to upset other people if there's no other way to get attention, right? It's the classic, well, if you have three little pigs, you have the stories of the ponytails and the inkwell. Do you know the boy who takes the girl's ponytail, who sits in front of him in school and puts it in the little jar of ink, right? Just to really have her turn around and go, ah! And it's like, little jolt of life came out of her eyes. Yeah, it was hot. It was pretty fiery, but so better than being ignored. Which women don't know. Women don't know what men will do to get our attention, because our attention gives life. It has the spark of us in it. And shortly before my husband died, he actually admitted to our daughters that he liked to get me wound up.
I love that.
And sometimes he did things, because I'm such a fighter. Sometimes he did things just he liked the intensity of it. Crazy, crazy. So anyhow, so I keep encountering all these different ways that women emasculate men. And it finally got to where, you know, and some women I could help through it, and they actually would transform just from a conversation. Some women just not at all. And I knew I didn't know how to write a book that wouldn't have, because I'd already done it, that wouldn't have the information just turned against men. Like I had to have a, this is going to sound funny, but it had to be like a trap, right? It had to be something that had people get beyond their own identities, beyond the guards of defense, beyond feeling attacked themselves, right? Because you talk to somebody head on about what they're doing wrong, right? Which is how it can occur. We're going to be defensive. And so I knew all these things that had to be, and I knew I didn't know how to write it. And that I needed to interact with more women at a time in different settings to find out all the things that the book needed to account for, needed to address, needed to help women with. Does that make sense?
So much.
So, yeah. So I knew I had a lot of research still to do. And this was now December of 1994. And I told Joan, I think I need to do a workshop so I can teach more women. And in the teaching of them, they can teach me how to write this book. And she wanted to do that with me. She wanted everybody to know what I knew, and so we tried our first workshop the next month, and it was so scary, but it worked way better than I thought it would, and this element entered that I like to be truthful about, or you don't really understand the book, or even it seems like a long answer to your what should be short question, why 10 years later. Leading the workshop the first day, we put together this one day workshop, and right in the middle of doing it, not knowing where to get them from where they were to what they were hoping for. It was called Celebrating Men, Satisfying Women, right? Nine women, right? In Joan's living room. And I didn't know how to get them from men are stupid and insensitive and mean and abusive and like all these things that the women were outflowing, like just let it out, let it out, let it out. How to get them from there to what if we're not seeing all of it? Right? What if we're not seeing the whole picture? And right in the middle of standing in front of them, it came to me. It just came, like just came. It wasn't from some part of my mind. It was, thank you, thank you, thank you, you know? And that has never ceased, right? Since then, right? We're getting close to 30 years of our workshops and over 30 years of studying men. And so what happened, Candace, is it took from 1995 to like 2009. Yeah, 2009 for me to learn and learn and learn and teach and teach and teach and teach, you know, and go into every area, sex and marriage and family and all these things. It took that long before one evening I got back from a full moon horseback ride with my dear friend. And suddenly I knew that I could write it. Oh my gosh, I can write this. And then it was even more strange because the same thing happened with the Keys to the Kingdom, but I didn't trust it. So the prequel to the key to the Queen's Code, because I knew I needed to write something, but I didn't know how to write the Queen's Code yet. So I wrote the prequel, Keys to the Kingdom. And it happened when I wrote Keys to the Kingdom as well. But I honestly, there was no reason to think it would happen again, but it did. I sat down in front of my laptop and all I can explain is it's like a screen. Like a movie screen, and it's right here, up here. And this movie started playing, and I started typing. And I would type until I was exhausted. And then I would go be a mom and a wife. And then I'd come back the next morning and look at this mess, because I'm not a great typist, and I'd clean up the mess that got written down, just hoping and praying that by the time I got it cleaned up, that the movie would begin again, not knowing if it would. And it did. And so I typed and typed and typed and typed and typed and typed. And I did this day after day for about 3 weeks. And I never knew what was going to come next. I never knew. I didn't know so much about these eight people, right? You know, Raul, you know, and his gum chewing in order not to smoke, and Jack and his signature toothpick, and in chapter five, is it the chapter six? In chapter six, when there's a certain dinner date, I didn't know any of that was going to happen. I didn't know. I knew there was something special about the chair that Kimberly sat in, but I hadn't seen it, just like she hadn't seen it. I didn't see it until she did. And I mean, I was trying to tell someone what it was like, because I didn't relate at the time to the word channeling. That didn't make sense to me until I had to edit a bunch of videos of me teaching. And there were things that Allison was saying that I didn't know. I'm like, ooh. And if you've ever been in and I think everybody has been in a bathtub, right? And you decide to like just let yourself slide down in it and your head go underwater, but you can see and hear, right? You're still feel like yourself. That's what it's like. And the story and the twists and the turns of the story. And so much of this, you know, some of it I knew consciously, like I knew it had to be from different points of view, right? It couldn't just be Kimberly's point of view talking about the others. It couldn't just be a couple points of view, because like Kimberly, you get to see her in the workplace and you get to see her being a friend and you get to see her being a granddaughter and you get to and you get to see these other people's perspective of her, how they see her, which we're all in our own blind spot. We're clueless how other people see us. And that's one of the biggest things I learned from men. We're clueless how beautiful we are to them, right? That where our eyes see flaws, right? We literally don't see the same way. We see flaws and where they see beauty. They're nurtured by beauty. So their brains scream for beauty. And they even see beauty in the things that we see flaws. Oh, I love how your teeth are crossed in the front. Or I think that's so cute how, you know, when you smile, your one eye crinkles more than the other. Or, I mean, they like literally all our imperfections. And I was talking to my boyfriend about, because he said something about his sisters getting made up. You know, he has two older sisters and two younger sisters. And it was so fun when they got made up. And I had a woman's reaction to makeup. We use makeup to hide flaws. We use makeup to have small eyes look bigger and wide eyes look, right? We like, whatever we think is wrong, we use makeup to try to fix it. And I finally asked him, because I don't like to wear makeup. I mean, I make up for this, right? The rest of the time. No. And I finally asked him, what is it that you like about makeup? And he said, I just always liked how it called attention. I always liked how it called attention to their eyes or their cheeks or their cheekbones or their lips. It called attention to it. What?
What?
It wasn't about fixing something. It's about exclamation marks, you know, like, look here. Ooh. like putting little neon around the things that would be really wonderful to notice. And And this I learned in a couple months ago, right? So 31 years into this, I learned something else. Okay. So I'm going to answer your question now.
I'm loving this. I'm loving it so much. I'm taking so many notes as you speak.
This is about your experience of listening to the Queen's Code. Because what happened was, from the moment we published the Queen's Code, which is its whole other God-given plan. I was literally given a plan. This is how to do it. And 2 years and hundreds of thousands of dollars later, we published it on the internet, a chapter at a time, a week at a time, and I interacted with the people who were reading it. And within 3 weeks, it was in 70 countries. We didn't plan for that at all. I did ask for how to publish this for the widest possible distribution, but our website didn't even have a country space in it. People were putting their cities in the city space. The city of their country. And every morning I'd be like, where is, right? You know, Macedonia, a 5,000-year-old city, Macedonia, right? Cape Town, when Cape Town showed up, I blew it. I just burst into tears. Do you know, it was just, oh my goodness. The West Bank. Oh my goodness. I mean, just over and over again. But anyhow, So immediately following that, people wanted the audiobook. And we published an audiobook of the Keys of the Kingdom. I wasn't willing for anybody else to read it because I was the one that watched the movie, right? How are they going to know the intonation, the personality? How are they going to know that people are reading and making it up, right? So I'd done an audiobook. I knew what it took. And you know how you find out later why you did something? When you're doing it, you think there's one reason. I don't have time. I have other things to do. It's not that important. Then last year, this is a year ago when I started recording it, and from the very first chapter, I came home to Dan. I was like, oh my gosh, this is so much more intense than I knew it was going to be. And I haven't even gotten to the hard part. Chapter three, the hard part, I haven't even gotten there. I can't imagine what it's going to be like for women to listen to this. The audio is so much more intense than anyone would have read the book to themselves. And I think we couldn't do it for 10 years because I wasn't big enough. You know, I wasn't big enough. And my staff, I started talking to my staff about, we have to be prepared to hold a much bigger space for the people listening to this, because it's so much more intense. It happens so fast, right? Like, you're reading a chapter and three chapters later, you're interacting with men completely different. Like, even less than that, it can happen in by the first chapter, just the hope. Oh my gosh, there's another way. How other way, right? And so that's why I think it took 10 years for us to even engage in it, who I had to become in the process, who my staff had to become. Cindy Love, for example, our senior customer care person, she literally could lead workshops for us. She knows and so much of what we do, and she has such compassion for the women going through it, you know, and so much love, and people can call her up and to make the vow out loud if they want to. And she's supposedly somebody processing refunds if you need it, you know? So I cried and laughed my way through recording it. There's so many retakes I had to do because I was sobbing. There's so much in that book. I'm on like my sixth time. I listen to the book because I'm interacting with people listening to it. We've been doing this week by week, and I'm going to start it again the beginning of November. And I listen to it so that I'm present to the chapter we're working on. And I'm surprised again. I didn't know we talked about that. I didn't know she taught that. I didn't know. So I may sound crazy, but it's magical. And as you know, from reading the book, it's the kind of thing you can just open the page anywhere, right? And you'll get something you need. It's stunning that way. I'm in awe of it. I don't own that. I didn't write it. I didn't write that book. I typed that book. I tried to figure out how to describe, you know, I'm seeing this. How do you say that, right? I didn't know it was going to end when it ended. Like, it was, okay, we're done. Movie over, the end. Oh. okay.
Oh. You know, what I find so fascinating with the way you've been telling us this process, number one, I love how passionate you are about the book, because there's so much emotion that I felt through you reading the audiobook. There were so many moments in it where I felt like a particular kind of way. And yes, some of it was because of my own reflection looking back at me, where I was just like, woo, okay, this is me. This is what I do. But then there was also a lot of it where I think there's a beauty in you reading the book, because there are points and moments that I feel like I would have lost if I was reading it for myself. I think there were moments I would have definitely not taken in as much or in the right way, because I think my own bias would have come into the fore. Whereas when you read the book, there's so much just ease at where exactly you go up, right? And where you really start to ease us into the story, or how you share the story, where it's like, this is a funny moment. Like, this is actually really funny, or this is actually very thoughtful. And even the idea of frog farming, like, I think even though like it's so early on in the book, it is such a brilliant concept. And I think so many women, I mean, I'm included, have been a frog farmer. Right. We meet a great guy and we 100% turn him into a frog. And you're like, all men are terrible. But you're the common denominator. And what I really want to ask you is, I know you told us about the, you know, watching the movie, and you ran through a very beautiful process of channeling how this information got channeled to you and how you really got it onto paper and then into audio form. When you were creating these characters, because they're such brilliant characters, how did they take shape for you first before you started really putting them down?
They didn't. I knew from an early experience in 1992, I was trying to tell my not yet sister-in-law, I was trying to tell her something about her husband. Because I could see conflicts happening between them, because he'd become a king, as we teach in Keys of the Kingdom. He'd become a king, and she was interacting with him as if he was a man that she had raised, which is common for wives when we be, you know, so much like, I raised you to be this, and I'm still the boss. And when a man becomes a king, it's like, you ain't the boss of me. Nobody's the boss of me but me. And I was trying to tell her something because I saw, and of course it was within a couple of years, they were divorced. And I saw it coming. And I was trying to tell her, and she was ignoring it. Like, she just didn't care. She kept her shopping together, and she just kept changing the subject. And there was nothing about it that resonated with her. So then I started telling her this story that's called The Princess and the Swamp Rat. And it's a story that a friend of mine and I made up when I first started studying men, and about how women change to attract a man. And we end up in the swamp. We end up in the swamp with the man. We become a swamp rat, right? Because we dive into the swamp with them. Instead of knowing who we are and inspiring them to rise to the level we're existing at, and inspiring them, encouraging them, having them feel like they really could do that and win at that. But if they're not trying hard enough, bye-bye. No, you don't want to be this man? This isn't your vision of being a man? Then that's fine. This isn't a fit. You want to live in my castle, but not become the man who can own doing that? No, this isn't going to work. So I started telling her the story of the princess and the swamp rat. She stopped in her tracks, and her husband came to pick us up, and she's like, wait, shh, shh, shh. Allison's telling a story. And I went, oh, that's how this book has to be. And when we were, I guess it's 1993, we were driving home, and this sounds weird, but I was lying down in the back of the car, and I had a shopping bag, and the story first started coming, right? And so Claudia and her rheumatic fingers and it began with what ended up being the Keys of the Kingdom. And all this, I didn't develop the characters. Mike, who could develop Mike? He's Italian from Chicago, but he thinks of himself as a cowboy, right? And he always thinks of his wife as that filly, you know, and he's just crazy about that filly, you know, and with her tatas and all her curves. I didn't develop them, honestly. I didn't. They showed me who they are. And my husband's nephew, after he read Keys to the Kingdom, which only has four characters, right? And he said to me, if I looked out my window and saw Bert and Claudia and Karen and Mike chatting on the sidewalk, I wouldn't be surprised. Like they're so real. And okay, we'll keep the weirdness up. I didn't know this was going to be the weirdness interview. So I I'm officially in my first trimester of being pregnant with the sequel to The Queen's Code. And yeah, and how it happened was about 4 years ago. I can only think of it as like checking in, but it feels like there's another dimension where they all live and I just check in. So what's happening with you guys? How's it going over there? And then they show me, right? Like in Keys of the Kingdom, I woke up knowing that Karen was going to see this table, right? They've been talking about this special table they sat at, this carving of birds. And I woke up knowing that Karen was going to see what was so special about this table today. And I said out loud, I talk that way. I'm like, so do you think I should see it? And then immediately I saw the table and burst into tears at the table. And so I didn't develop them. They develop themselves, and they're all based in real men that I listened to, that I studied men by watching them. They all men who are on our panels, men who in some ways, Jack is a lot like my husband, Greg, but also not, do you know? Which is why I gave him a toothpick. Greg thought toothpicks were disgusting. That's the only thing I did voluntarily. I gave him a toothpick.
Oh my goodness. I am loving this, and I'm loving all the different directions. You know, Alison, the one thing that struck me as well in The Queen's Code is this way that you had of talking about physical intimacy. I think there's so often that we can strip that part away, right? We want to give women the skill set and the tools and the, you know, on how to get the man to take out the garbage, which is also amazing. But we strip that out of the equation. So why was it so important for you to actually address sex?
Well, early on, when I first found out I was a frog farmer, and there were three men in my life that I was their coach. We didn't call it coaching back then. I called it committed listening. So they would tell me what was happening in their businesses. They were all single and they were all self-employed. And they would tell me what was happening in their businesses. And I was like the blackboard. They would just say it all. And then I would point something out back to them. And they, because I wasn't romantically involved with them, because I didn't need anything from them, I was more open to them than in another context, like even like my brothers or father or in any romantic man, and even friends, right? I was more open to them because I was just there to serve, right? I was there to serve them. And they talked about sex. And I, because I was more open and not defensive, I could hear how important sex was to them, not just from which they would describe to me the physical need and how the physical need for sex can overcome and break through single focus and make it so they can't focus on their work because they hear high heels. They're at work and the high heels go clickety clock down the hall and they're like, when the drive, right? It hits this emergency level. It builds and builds and builds, and then it's this emergency level, and it's so distracting. Well, they described that to me, but they also described the connection, that how spiritual and emotional and tender and nurturing and like the what men would say is like we're not now it's gotten a little bit different. If you just take out COVID, like men started to be able to hug, right? Like hug, they'd hug each other, kind of the bro hug, you know, or friends, you know, male and female friends would hug each other more. But, you know, this is the 1990s. And what they expressed to me was a man could go weeks with nothing more than a handshake. Do you know, and just for a woman, like to put her hand on his hand, it just like say, thank you. That touch was so intense to them. And there's so much we don't know about men, how much they need to be touched by us, as well as what they get from touching us. Their batteries are recharged from the energy that comes out of our skin. And the more well we are, the energy that the radiance that comes out of our faces, it's like, it literally is like the sun warming them, and they have a solar powered battery, and they're good to go. And I asked my son once, you know, he was doing our course for men called Being Extraordinary as a Man. And he was in that course, he was in his mid-20s, and he was making a list of all the things that nurtured him and contributed to him. And one of the things he wrote down was a real woman's smile. And I asked him, you know, what happened? And he goes, well, just like walking down a street, if a woman smiles at me, there's this energy, and I'm more, and I feel, you know, like it changes me. And I said, how long does it last? And he said, it'll last the whole day. And I mean, he can articulate this at like 25 years old. And we started asking men on our panels, you know, what is the effect of a woman's smile? They would go on and on about the effect of a woman smiling at them. And this really snazzy, he reminds me of a really famous, very smooth actor, like just so elegantly dressed and like this. And we asked, like, you know, if a man is looking at you, like in a bar, he's looking at you, why doesn't he approach? And this man who you think would approach anybody anytime, right? He was so all that. It's like, well, if she's not smiling, like what? Well, if she's not smiling, I wouldn't get out of my chair. And if she was smiling at me, I'd start to get out of my chair. And then if she's still smiling, I'd take another step. And if she's still smiling, still smiling, still smiling. I mean, this person that you would think would be brash with women, right? No, she's smiling, smiling, smiling. Our rejection, when they look at us and think, whoa, she's something special, right? I'm going to take a risk for this. We have no idea how they got going on, because, you know, they're looking cool, right? So fun.
It's so romantic, yes. Though. There's so much it's just so beautiful. Like I can't think of any person who's listening to us right now who wasn't smiling as much as I was, as you were just describing these moments, because so often we taught to believe, and this is what I also love about the Queen's Code, that men are brutes, right? They don't feel the way we feel. We the overly romantic ones. We the ones that have to constantly put ourselves out there. And that's what I love about the Queen's Code, where you address misbehaving and you also address how validating men is so much more powerful than scolding them, which I think is a lot of women. It's like, you know, I'm going to punish you into submission or into doing what I want. And I want you to talk a little bit about that, please, Alison, about the power of that female praise, that female validation to a man.
I will, and I want to tie it into finishing the question you asked, which I was like, what question was that? Why was there sex in the Queen's Code? There's sex in the Queen's Code because to a man, a romantic relationship has sex in it. That's to them the definition of a romantic relationship. It's there's someone that you think is special. You enjoy being with them. You feel better off by knowing them and spending time with them. And you get to have sex with them. Those two things. We talk about those different kinds of attraction in the Making Sense of Men book, the only nonfiction book I've ever written. Actually, you know, wrote it. Go figure. And so it's part and parcel. And also in the way that I would say it now, I think we talked about this last time, the hierarchy of instincts, right? It's procreate, then protect, then provide. And we want other people to be in provide, but then we do things that have them feel like they have to protect something. And if they feel like they have to protect themselves from us, it's the very worst, right? Well, it starts with procreate though. So if you think of it as an upward spiral, sexual energy is the life force of the planet, not just human beings. It's the planet's life force. And it gives men the fuel to protect and the fuel to provide. It's what keeps it spinning. And when I discovered this in my own marriage, Greg had decided he would decide that I was too tired to have sex. And he kept deciding it. And he would even veto me. I had a practice with Greg because I knew how scary it was for him to initiate sex with me, even his wife. He doesn't, that's the worst, to be rejected by your own wife. So I knew how scary that was. So I watched him to see when the meter was rising. And when it was too high, he'd get really weird. He's like, because fascist can get all bunched up, you know? And I would initiate sex. And I started paying attention, like every 3 to 3.5 days, he's going to look like that. So I could keep him in good shape if I initiated, you know, early in the third day instead of waiting. And so I generated, for the first 20 years of our marriage, I generated our sex life. He did not have to initiate. And I didn't have to want to. It didn't matter whether or not I wanted to. Once we got going, I knew it would turn out. He was an amazing lover, right? So I would initiate and initiate and initiate. And so funny. But then he started deciding I was too tired. And so I'd initiate and he would not accept because he decided it'd be better for me to not. And then his, like, oh my gosh, what happened to us? Because that connection wasn't happening. That fuel for him to be my protector and provider wasn't happening. The whole thing was unwinding. And as you can see, Karen and Mike, they're really upset at the beginning of the Queen's Code because this trying to make a baby, right, has ruined their sex life, which has been is the fuel for the whole dynamic between them. And it's why, Candace, I encourage women to flirt. Do you know, women don't know how much men flirt with your husband, flirt with your boyfriend. They don't know, like we talk about in chapter 5, how much men need to feel desired. We're so worried about us feeling desired and being desirable and attractive. We don't know they have as much or more going on about it than we do. Because to them, we're inherently attractive. What does she see in me, right? How am I going to be good enough for her? And so even something like when you kiss him goodbye in the morning or whatever, when you kiss him goodbye or kiss him hello, put yourself into it. Do the yoga of kissing. Put your consciousness into your face, right? So that when you're kissing him, we have the saying, where your consciousness goes, your life force flows. So you put your consciousness into the and just hold it a little bit longer, just, right? And have some desire in there, you know, some here you go when I want you. And whoa, I can just... And you can have sex once a month, but if you kiss like that every day, it would feel like you were having sex every day. Like, because sexual energy would be present. And so it had to be in the queen's code, because part of being a queen is being life-giving, filling ourselves up from our lives so we have more life force to flow to them. That's what a queen does. She does it for a whole realm. Like,
oh my goodness, Allison. I think that's going to be one of our takeaways, which is be in the yoga of kissing. And how you demonstrated was just absolute perfection to me. I was like, yes. And I love the idea of, you know, especially, but I mean, the Queen's Code, and I can't believe we're coming to the end of our interview, but one of the things about the Queen's Code that I really do love, and I mentioned this at the top of the interview, is not only does it teach you to, you know, how to understand me, which is a huge part of the book, and I love that, but to me, there's also such a massive self-development aspect to it, about looking internally, looking at myself and seeing how I'm not just falling short, maybe in this area that I think is my big problem, which is just men, right? Men are the issue. But how realistically in your life that you showing up as a queen and you showing up within that energy, within that essence, it really raises the vibration of your whole life. It's not just about one area. And I think you did that so smart. And I want to know, was there a little bit of that intention in there? Because that's one of my biggest takeaways.
Not like as a specific. It happened to me. Right. It by interacting with men and finding out what they really thought and what they really needed and what really hurts and really connects, I changed. I transformed. And I got we're always worrying about having more respect from men. Right? How do you get more respect? We don't know that they start with so much respect for us, and then we bring it down by the way that we interact with them. We crush it. We turn it to disdain. We take bites out of it. We don't know they already love us. They already respect us. They're already in awe of who women are and what we can do, because to them, we're so different than them. They're not trying to be the same as us or talk themselves into they don't need us. Like one man said, you're the unicorns in the forest. And so as they described women to me, it changed the way I saw women, which I didn't know I needed to do anything about how I saw women. And then it changed how I saw myself and who I could be. And I wanted to be what they saw in me. So there wasn't an intent in the book to make sure that showed up, because I didn't ever have that. I just was tasked with writing a book that would transform the way women related to men. And I didn't know, because it was pretty far into those almost 15 years of learning how to write it, I didn't know how much men didn't know about themselves. They don't know why they do what they do. And it's part of the joy for me of the audiobook being out now is it's the Queen's Code is becoming part of the men's movement because of a beautiful man who his name is Will Spencer, and he has a project called The Renaissance of Men. And he fell in love with the Queen's Code And we've become friends because he said it was the first thing he'd ever read written by a woman that taught him something about being a man and was in praise of men. And for men, what we're discovering is reading the Queen's Code is helping them to understand what has us do what we do. Like when Jack realized that he had scared Kimberly, that this, you know, frostier than a shaken martini was a reaction of how afraid she was of his attraction to her from the very beginning. And that's a very normal thing to happen, right? And so for men to get to see, oh, this is why I do that, this is why I need this, they can start to not allow women to emasculate themselves. A woman can still behave the same way, but he can actually be impervious to what's happening because of being able to see behind it. Oh, she's afraid. She's afraid. And then they have such compassion and they don't want us to ever be afraid. It's horrifying to them that such creatures as us would be afraid of them. Their job is to protect us. And they're horrified when they attack us. They're horrified and so ashamed of their reactions. And so what you're talking about is just part of the magic of the Queen's Code. And if you listened all the way to the end, the very last words in the Queen's Code are my addendum to the acknowledgement. Because after Greg died in 2019, and then I met Dan in 2020, right? His support and encouragement is part of how I could do the audio. And the last words, you know, are thanking him. Oh my gosh, when he heard those, I didn't tell him I put it in there. And what it says, right? He gives me an opportunity every day to practice the Queen's Code. I have to be on my toes.
Wow. Alison Armstrong. I cannot actually think of a better place to end this interview, because what you've just spoken about, especially at the end there, that captures why every human being should have the Queen's Code in their library. And now there's no excuse. You can listen to it while you are doing things around, you know, you're out and about, you're in your car, you're commuting in some way. And I just want to thank you. I want to thank you for this book. I cannot wait for the next one. I know that you've mentioned it. I'm like, yay, us. But Alison, before I let you go, I've got two questions for you. And
okay.
One is, what is a thought that's currently percolating in your mind at the moment?
Oh, wow. This part of my life has been so unexpected, you know. I thought I was going to be 81 when Greg died. That was just like the deal. I'll marry you if you give me 50 years. and he gave me 28. But he left behind poetry that I'd never read. He'd written it 3 years before he died. And one of the poems in there described what it was like to die and described what our life would be like now. So they say the soul knows, the soul knows and the soul's preparing. And as I read what he had written, it said, this part of our life, one of the sections was, this part of our life is about the fulfillment of your wishes and dreams. And I was taken aback because I have a mission and purpose. called Heaven on Earth. And we need to transform the way women and men relate to men and women and themselves and each other. We need to transform that, or we're never going to have heaven on earth. I didn't know that I got to have wishes and dreams too. And so, like, the Queen's Code audiobook and putting everything into it that it demanded, and doing everything that it takes for people to know it's here. This story is here and being told in a way that it comes to life. And these people will be as real to you as they are to me. So I'm fulfilling a lot of things. There's a lot of completion in one side, and then there's newness on the other side. That, and this may sound very odd, but I get to now teach things that I've been working on for almost a decade. It's kind of a theme, I guess. I work on something for a long time before it gets to come out, that have to do with being human. Not, it's before female, it's before male. It's human instincts, human characteristics, things that we all do, regardless of age, race, ethnicity, economics, religion. We all do these at the heart of who human beings are, both the dark and the light. And until we shed the light on the dark, we're going to keep being this way. We're going to keep doing these things. And so next week, I get to start a new series. It's called Finding Humor in Being Human. Because if we don't have a sense of humor about the dark, there is no light shown in the dark, not sustainably. And so that's what's there. That's what's present, is I'm fulfilling this thing that started 30 years ago, and getting to now, because it's being fulfilled, I get to now express sort of how horizons work. Do you know, as you're approaching the horizon, a new horizon appears?
Oh. Allison, you are someone I could honestly speak to for, I wish I could speak to you today. Honestly, I'm like, my life would be exponentially better if I just got to speak to you every single day. But Allison, thank you so much. And where can people find you?
They can find me at AllisonArmstrong.com, which is where you would get, for example, the Queen's Code audiobook. And now there's the Allison Armstrong mobile app that you download, and then you can listen to Keys of the Kingdom and the Queen's Code there. You can also read the books on the app. That just finally happened last week. And you'll, you know, if you want to participate in finding humor and being human, like if someone gender's not that interesting to them, they want to get beneath that. You can find that there right on the homepage, and it starts next week, and there's no prerequisites. You don't have to have done anything.
Amazing. Yay. Allison, thank you so much as always. It's been such an honor speaking to you.
Thank you. Thank you.
I absolutely love that conversation. It did not disappoint, because Allison is remarkable. Make sure to comment with what has stood out for you below in the comments. Thank you so much, and I look forward to serving you again next week.